thing that's very interesting. If you look at the very last verse, or the last two verses, verse 30 and 31, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. How did he die that night, and Darius the Mede, the Medes and the Persians take over immediately? Because they're at the gates. Right? This party is going on while the conquering nation is a few miles away from them. The commentator's a little bit different suggestions, but probably what's happening is Belshazzar knew the Medes and the Persians were coming to destroy him. And he says, you know what, let's just have a lavish, grand party. Let's enjoy our last few hours. And so that's the kind of idolatry that is going on here. Let's enjoy our last 3 hours before we're conquered and killed. So what about idolatry in our culture and in our lives? In our culture, you know, it was interesting, you know, there was a Twitter IPO this week. And within 3 hours of the IPO, it was downgraded to a sell. Right? So it started, you know, stock people, they rate stocks whether you should buy it, hold it, or sell it. And so initially, I think everybody said, go ahead, buy Twitter at 25. It went to like 48. And so within 3 hours, and so all the brokers are like, okay, we're downgrading to a sell, or at least a hold, if not, or a sell. So irrational exuberance, again, wins the day in terms of, so people bid the stock up within 3 hours so high that all the people that kind of think about these things said, you've overvalued it so much, you should sell it now because it's not worth people are paying for it. So it's just a symptom of greed. Right, greed is one of those images one of those idols that's in our culture, and in some ways, the Twitter IPO is just a symbol of that. There's also Kathy saw this reference to this book that's called "Sex and God at Yale," which is kind of a follow-on from this book in the 50s written by William Buckley about man and God at Yale. But it just kind of it illustrates at Yale University the degradation of our culture in terms of, especially in terms of like encouraging an idolatrous sexuality and just warning in terms of that. Someone says, how Yale goes, there goes the country. And so those are just two little images of idolatry in our culture. And you can think of other things in our culture that are idolatrous, of how worship is taken away from God towards various things. But it's really easy to do that and to kind of look down on other people in our culture from afar and cast stones and say, look at you bad people who are engaged in idolatry. But we really need to bring it home and say, where are my idols? So this is kind of a hard, you probably think, well, you know what, I haven't thrown any riotous parties, I didn't rob any temples recently, and use their cups and saucers. But kids, what if you had a grand party and you thought, let's just throw all the stops out, let's get our Legos together and let's make chalices out of Legos, and then let's praise the gods of Legos and plastic and things like that. I asked the kids in communicants class, what if you were going to throw an idolatrous party? What would go on? You would praise the gods of cookies, is what they said, and praise the gods of Doritos, of Wii, of pizza. Some of you might, if you're going to go all out, praise the gods of Snapchat and various things like that. But so how do we get from this idolatrous image of Belshazzar to our lives? I think there's three ways we do that. We look at if the concrete examples of what he's doing don't connect to us, then we look at the motives underneath them. So what is he doing by throwing this feast with the Medes and Persians out of the front gate? He's avoiding. He's avoiding what's coming. He's avoiding what he knows is about to happen. And so that's the first motive. The second motive, what's he doing with these Right, praising the gods of gold and silver. What's he doing with these cups and chalices from the temple in Jerusalem? He's abusing. Right? He's abusing things from their intended purpose. And these things were made for objects of worship, and God gave us lots of things in creating the world. But if we abuse them and we make them from created things that were made for our good into things that we worship, then we're abusing them. And then third, they praise the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. They're adoring things that are just made things. They're not adoring. They're not showing adoration to who really deserves that. So I think that's one way for us to get at our idols, to say, what do we avoid? What are we avoiding that we really know we ought to be working on? We ought to be planning for. We ought to think and pray about. What are we avoiding? What are we abusing? What are we using that's in the wrong manner? What are created things that God gave to us for our good, but that we twist around and use to meet some satisfaction within us, but in ways that God never intended? And then, what do we really adore? What do we love and to spend our time and money and attention on instead of God? So we need to make sure that we don't just say those terrible idolatrous people, but we need to start realizing what are our idols and then what's underneath those idols. So what happens next is God confronts our idolatry. So in verse 5, it says, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, his thoughts alarmed him, his limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. So in last chapter, in chapter 4, God confronts Nebuchadnezzar's idolatry with this dream. Here he confronts Belshazzar with crazy thing, right? This hand who appears and starts to write on this plaster walls, and it seems very imaginary, although they did excavate this environment, and they didn't find the handwriting, but they did find plaster on the walls. And so there's just a little piece of historical evidence of that moves us towards encouraging us to believe what's going on here. So God uses a supernatural thing to confront Belshazzar of his idolatry, and it works, right? In terms of the king's color changed, his thoughts alarmed him, his limbs gave way, his knees knocked together. He's really called him, he's done something that's called him to realize he's in trouble, that emotionally, that intellectually, he doesn't know how to deal with this. He knows he's in trouble. And oftentimes that happens to us. God convicts us or confronts us in one way or another. We may not know the fullness of it initially, but we realize our emotions are way out of whack. We realize we're afraid. We realize various things show up that says, God's doing something in my life. I need to pay attention. So what does Belshazzar do? This is part of the dots here. He calls in, of course, his magicians, and they can't answer the situation. And then the queen, probably his mother perhaps, comes in and says, you know, you remember there's this guy Daniel in your kingdom. You really should call him to help you out. So verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I've heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding, excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, enchanters have been brought before me to read this writing, make known the interpretation. They cannot show the interpretation, but I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. And now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have chains of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. I think we see another image of Belshazzar's idolatry here. He thinks just by casting out wealth and privilege, he can get what he wants, right? There's an element of, I can buy my way out of this situation, or I can bring the expert in, I'll pay you and give you some honor, but it'll keep me safe. So then we end up, we come to Daniel's response. So Daniel says, first, let your gifts be for yourself, your rewards for another. Nevertheless, I will read to the king and make known to him interpretation. O king, the Most High God. So the first thing that Daniel's going to say in terms of how we correct our idolatry, or how we temper or stop idolatry, is we need to learn from the past. So verse 18 says, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty, and became one of the great, and because of that greatness, he gave him all peoples, nations, languages to tremble and fear before him. Whom he would, he killed. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. Whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne. His glory was taken from him. He was driven from among children of mankind. His mind was made like that of a beast. His dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God ruled the kingdom of man, sets it over whom he will. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you've lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. So he's recounting what happened last chapter of how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. But the point he's making here first is, Belshazzar, you knew that your father was humbled, and yet you didn't humble yourself. Right? You saw what God did to your father and the lessons that he taught him, and yet it didn't make any response to you. So that's one of the reasons that Belshazzar is being convicted here, but it's one of the things that is supposed to keep us from idolatry, is that we're supposed to learn from past lessons. And so in one sense, for us, Scripture is that testimony of what's happened in the past. And so we need to learn from it. Jesus talks about the same point when he, in Matthew 16, he says to his disciples, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then they say to each other, we didn't bring bread. Oh no, he's worried because we didn't bring bread. And he says, don't you remember the bread that I made for the feeding of the 4,000 and the feeding of the 5,000? How much was left over? So in that situation, Jesus is rebuking them about worrying about bread because they had experienced him making bread for the 4,000 and 5,000. So Jesus expected them to start to learn. You don't have to worry about bread with me, right? Remember, you experienced feeding the 4,000, 5,000. So in a similar way, there's a time sometimes where God holds us accountable to what we know or what we should have known, what we've seen and experienced, or what we have laid out in Scripture before us. And so we bear a responsibility. Belshazzar bore a responsibility because he saw how God interacted with his father, and yet he didn't learn from it. We need to learn from history. We need to learn from how God's interacted in our lives. So then verse 22, so you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. So the second thing is here, he's calling Belshazzar to compare idols with the living God, right? He's saying you are worshiping the gods of silver, gold, bronze, which do not see or hear or know. So that's very important, because that shows up throughout Scripture a lot whenever it talks about idolatry. Idols don't really see, right? Idols don't really hear. They don't really know what's going on. But the living God does. Right, so in Isaiah you'll hear you've made images of wood and stone and you bow down to them, but they can't talk, They can't see. They have eyes, but they can't see. They have ears, but they can't hear. They don't know. And so he's repeating this similar critique against idols. So he's calling that for a comparison. And so we also need to stop ourselves and do a comparison. Compare the things that we are worshiping. What are the idols that we're tempted to follow after, or that we are in some way or another following after? How do they actually compare to God, the living God? If I worship comfort, does comfort actually hear my prayers? Does comfort actually see me? Does comfort actually know what I need? No, it doesn't. It can't, right? But God does. God uniquely hears us. God uniquely sees our situation, and He knows what we need and how to lead us forth. So this is, we need to create a practice of comparing what we're tempted to worship with the living God. I think also when we see here in 23, you've praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, but the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you've not honored. I think in that but, there's something of a sense that all of our idolatry is at the expense of true worship. In other words, we sort of have a finite amount of worship. And it's not like I can worship God, but then I can also sort of, it's not that bad to have this little bit of worship over here of these idols, or these idols are drawing my heart away a little bit. But actually, any worship I give to idols is worship I'm not giving to the living true God. Right? So it's not something you can manage. You only, in one sense, have so much worship. And when some of it gets diverted, it means others of it is not going to the true and living God. And then Daniel interprets the handwriting. And so written on the wall are these four words, meeny, meeny, tinkle, parson. And the reason why they probably couldn't have read them, they probably, all the vowels dropped out and the consonants were crushed, were all pushed together. So and so you had to figure out what are the right vowels to insert back in. Here's the interpretation, verse 26. Of meaning, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tikal, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. So tikal means weigh, meaning means numbered. Peres means your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So Belshazzar gives the command. He clothes Daniel with purple, gives him the chain of gold. That very night, he is killed, and Darius the Mede comes in. So, this is a terrible situation where idolatries led to someone's demise, right? And so, our idolatries can be overcome, but we need to take them seriously, because if they're not overcome, they lead us in dangerous places. They lead us in destructive ways. And left unchecked, they result in our physical and spiritual death. So we need to work with them. We need to find them out and respond to them. We need to learn from the past. We need to actively be able to compare them with the grace and the mercy of the true living God. We need to realize our worship is drawn away from them. We need to realize they result in judgment. But here's one of the interesting things that helps us, encourages us to turn away from our idols and back to God is Belshazzar was seeking comfort in this banquet. But what's the image of the end of time of our life with God? It's a banquet. Right? So there is a great, wonderful, glorious banquet, the marriage supper of the Lamb, the wedding of the church to the bride, Jesus the groom. There is a banquet to come. Banquets aren't bad, but idolatrous banquets now lead us to death. But coming is the full, gracious banquet that God has prepared for us. In verse 4, they seem to be finding some pleasure in drinking wine and praising the gods of gold and silver, praising the things that they have. And yet we're supposed to find great pleasure in the worship of God. We're supposed to actually find satisfaction and contentment, not in some manufactured praising environment here, but we are supposed to find satisfaction in our worship of God. There's excess here, but Jesus says there's an abundance with God. And so there is a, God has in store for us, there, excess and abundance, what's the difference? They're both more than we need, both more than we could ask for. But one is bad and one is good. So God is orchestrating an abundance for us now and for all time. So when we realize, as you reflect more on this and you realize, oh, these are things I'm abusing, I'm avoiding, I'm adoring, what's our way forward? First, we have to realize that Jesus was weighed for us. Right, Belshazzar didn't have anyone to be weighed except himself. He was weighed and found lacking. And that's a frightful thing. We could think God weighing us and finding us lacking. But Jesus was weighed for us, and Jesus was not lacking in the slightest bit. Jesus passed every test. Jesus fulfilled everything that he should have, that humans should have. By faith in him, his weighing, the passing the test, is counted to us, so that we pass the test by faith in Jesus. And then we turn to this God who does hear us, and so we can pray. We can come to him because Jesus was weighed for us and passed the test. Father always hears Jesus. The Father always hears us, and so he will hear us. And he will see our situation, and he knows the best way out of our idolatry and back to himself to experience the abundance that he has for us. So let us learn what our idols are, but let us also learn especially how to turn away from them and how to turn in worship to the true and living God.